Y'all better think about this stuff right here. Live your life. Speak your mind.
Welcome. You've got Living Writers. I'm T. Hetzel, and today on the program, I'm so pleased to have David Stephen Kalan here in the studio. His book, Charles Bukowski, Absence of the Hero, Uncollected Stories and Essays, Volume 2, 1946 to 1992. And this book just out this April with City Lights. David, thanks for being here on the program.
Glad to be here.
It's great to see you. And you're going to be reading this evening at Borders.
Right.
7 p.m. And that's the downtown Borders.
Yes.
Right? So we've got that right. And this is actually volume two. So, and you've brought both with you. You brought volume one.
Right.
Portions from a wine-stained notebook.
Yeah.
A great title.
Fragmentos de un cuaderno manchado de vino in Spanish. I think in this Italian translation is... A cercare I cavalli vincenti, which is guessing the winning horses. So, yeah.
Oh, so they changed the title for the Italian volume?
Yeah, right.
Guessing the winning horses?
Yeah, because there's a piece in here about horse racing.
So. Oh, that's a great title, too. Both of them are. Well, welcome, and thanks for being here today on a busy day for you, because you just came from teaching class at Eastern Michigan University,
yes.
And it was a literary theory class, David? Okay. And so then you rolled on into here, and then after that you have Borders, so.
That's right.
Will you be reading portions from the book and talk and doing a discussion?
What I'll do is... I brought to show at Borders some of the underground newspapers that Bukowski wrote for because I thought people might be interested. He was very prolific during the 60s and wrote for the L.A. Free Press and for NOLA Express, which was a New Orleans underground newspaper, and even for a German underground kind of, what do you want to call it, a newspaper magazine slash called Klakto Vedsedstein, which is the name of a Charlie Parker song, I think, edited by Carl Wiesner in Heidelberg. And so I brought that.
And that's wonderful. And do you have them with you now, too? Or if only we had that webcam working already, we could...
No, they're in my car, unfortunately.
And so are those... Now, how did you come by those? Because is this something that's actually yours, or is it on loan from an archive?
No, actually, I started, the first time I heard about Bukowski was 1972. That was in L.A., and I was a student at UCLA, and I saw the Taylor Hackford documentary. I suppose Taylor Hackford's now known because he's the husband of Helen Mirren, mainly, but he was a Hollywood director, and he was drafted to do this sort of documentary of Bukowski, and it was shown.
Oh, so it wasn't his own volition, like it wasn't his own idea then?
Oh, no, maybe I shouldn't say that. I don't know the whole history, actually. I shouldn't have said that. No, but this was shown on PBS, and I was just electrified by Bukowski at that point. That was 72, so I was a kid. I was 20, 22 years old. And so I started reading his poetry, and then I read his novels and short stories. And then in the 80s, late 80s, 90s, I started to notice that many of his works hadn't been collected, that they were languishing in these underground newspapers and magazines. And so I started to find them through eBay and through libraries. Actually, I worked here at the U of M at the Labadie Library. There's an underground anarchist library in the special collections, and they have a pretty complete set of the LA Free Press and NOLA and I think Open City too, I've forgotten now, Berkeley Tribe. And so I spent hours Xeroxing stuff. So yeah, I've got a pretty good collection now.
And so you worked in the Labadie collection.
Right.
And so, because I noticed in the acknowledgments, Julie Herrera, who heads that up.
Right.
And it's anarchy, right? Is that also sort of the gist of the collection, anarchy? And is it underground press? And
I know the guy at Labadie was an anarchist, it's countercultural stuff, basically, right.
Oh, well, great. Okay. Yeah. Well, you know what? Without further ado, let me read your short bio in the back of the book as a way of introduction, David. And then if you wouldn't mind reading Charles Bukowski as well to give us a short intro with him, too. So David Stephen Colon is the author of William Saroyan, My Real Work is Being, The Colossus of Armenia, G.I. Gurdjieff, and Henry Miller, and Charles Bukowski, Sunlight, Here I Am, Interviews and Encounters, 1963 to 1993. A quick word about that. That's out with a Michigan press.
Yeah, Sundog Press in Northville.
Sundog Press. So we're going to talk a little bit about that later, too. For City Lights, he has previously edited the Bukowski anthology, Portions from a Wine-Stained Notebook, Uncollected Stories and Essays, 1944 to 1990. He has lectured in Paris and at many universities, including UCLA, the University of Chicago, and University of Pennsylvania, Columbia University, UC Berkeley, the European University Institute in Florence, the University of London, Harvard, and Oxford. He has taught at the University of Texas at Austin and the University of Michigan. Right here, folks, go blue. During spring term 2009, he taught a seminar on William Saroyan at the University of Chicago. Presently, he teaches at Eastern Michigan University. So a shout out to everyone over at EMU, too, who might be listening now. And some of your students, no doubt, en route to your reading this evening at Borders, 7 p.m.
Yeah, it was bizarre because today in the course you mentioned, the literary theory course, I mentioned that I'd be doing this, and I asked if there were anybody liked Bukowski or knew about him, and probably 8 or 9 students raised their hand, and actually a girl had a Bukowski T-shirt on, too. So I took that as a good omen. She didn't know anything about this is happening today. So the gods, as Bukowski would say, are smiling propitiously at us, I think.
And drinking some wine.
Yes, absolutely.
Well, David, would you mind reading
short
bio for Bukowski? Because I think, maybe he doesn't need any introduction, but let's just do it anyway.
Charles Bukowski was born in Andernach, Germany in 1920, brought to California at age 3. Although Bukowski spent 2 years at L.A. City College, he was largely self-educated as a writer. He spent much time in his youth in the Los Angeles Public Library, where he encountered some of the writers whose work would influence his own: Dostoevsky, Turgenev, Nietzsche, D.H. Lawrence, Celine, E.E. Cummings, Pound, Fante, and Saroyan. He was a prolific poet and prose writer, publishing more than 50 volumes. City Lights has published several Bukowski titles, including Tales of Ordinary Madness, Notes of a Dirty Old Man, The Most Beautiful Woman in Town, and Portions from a Wine-Stained Notebook, Uncollected Stories and Essays, 1944 to 1990. Charles Bukowski died in San Pedro, California on March 9, 1994.
Thanks, David. And now, did you write that bio of Bukowski for this edition?
I did, actually. I think I did. I'm trying to remember if it was revised by anybody, but yeah, I think that was my task.
Yeah, I was thinking that would be a piece of your writing. And we're going to hear also later on a piece from your introduction to the anthology. Now, is there going to be a volume 3 as well, since we're...
Yes, in fact, I'm working now on a Notes of a Dirty Old Man continued, so to speak. Because Bukowski was so prolific, the actual book, Notes of a Dirty Old Man, only contains, I think, about 40 columns, which are presented sequentially without any break. But he wrote several hundred of these columns for the Free Press and the newspapers I mentioned. So, and a lot of them are very, very fine. So that's what I'm working on now.
Great. Well, then you'll have to come back and we'll speak again for volume 3. But in the meantime, David, you said that you found Bukowski when you were 22 years old,
right?
And the poems, the prose electrified you.
Right.
How did you come by it? Was it just something that you found on the street? Did someone hand it to you? Did you have it in a class?
It was actually that the Hackford documentary. That was the first I'd heard of him,
right.
Which is odd because I had been in LA and L.A. is a funny place. I was born there, and you probably know it's sort of famous, at least it was in the 40s, because Thomas Mann was there, Aldous Huxley.
But wait, why were you... You were watching PBS.
Yeah, I was watching PBS.
As a 22-year-old college student.
Right.
So that's good. Good. But did you know it was coming on, or it just happened to come on, and you were watching it?
I have to say, it was... You know, at that point, I didn't know his work at all, but the man himself electrified me. I mean, I thought he was just a fascinating person, and a person of genius. He just struck me as completely honest, direct, and gifted and tortured. And, you know, suppose all the sort of things I, as a young person, identified with as a genius poet type, you know. And so I found him very interesting in that way. And also the fact that he loved classical music and that he mm-hmm. was dedicated to writing and that he was having trouble with women all the time and he was drinking too much and all that stuff made perfect sense to me.
And do you think it was that you were 22 and you happened to have him enter your life, or do you think like at 42 you would be you would have been as electrified because there's something maybe in his vulnerability or in his honesty that still connects, or was it the timing for you?
No, I think it was I think it would still be relevant. Of course, it was just coming off the end of the 60s, and I think that all that stuff was obviously in the air. That, I mean, he's sort of a Dionysian character for me, and I think that some of that had to do with the fact that I was young. But I think that, I mean, the writers that I liked at that age were Nietzsche and Dostoevsky and many of the writers that he adored, Thoreau. So he represented also a kind of anarchic, vital energy. But I think I would, if I just found out about him today, I'd still like him. Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I noticed that you also have this, the book Henry Miller as well. Were you also reading Henry Miller at the time?
Yes, I was. Right.
And was that sort of part of the gateway? Do you see them as, you know, compatriots or...
Well, it's interesting because, again, I'm a Californian, and I think there is a link between Bukowski, Saroyan, and Miller. Miller, of course, is from New York, but lived in California. But Saroyan particularly, I see, because my first book was on Saroyan. I'm half Armenian.
Yes.
My mother was Armenian. And Saroyan writes very beautifully about the Armenians of California, and he's also a very sensitive and poetic, lyrical writer. And I think Bukowski is also, and I think I see him... My interest in Bukowski, it's not that it came out of my interest in Saroyan, but I see them as very similar in that they also both write a very fine, pure English prose. Of course, Bukowski was German-American, and he suffered some prejudice as a child being German-American. And also the freedom of being a Californian. I think there's a lot of that in Bukowski and Saroyan. It's like this energy. It's free. It's open. There's no bars, and it's innocent. There's a kind of, I mean, a lot of people would balk to say that Bukowski is innocent, but I find him very much very childlike in many ways, very spontaneous and open. And and Miller, of course, because of his sort of anarchic side too, I think he's in that mix as well. Sort of not so much, well, anti-American. In the case of Bukowski, I don't think he's so much anti-American, but he's sort of disaffiliated. You know, he wasn't part of any of the system, if you will, and he didn't. I think in that way he's very close to Miller. And, of course, the, quote, obscenity question, I don't think that's really something that he got from Miller, but I think the sort of trenchancy and directness also, maybe that's German, I suppose. But there are certainly connections, and there's a piece in this new book about Henry Miller.
Living in Palisades.
Right.
Where is Bukowski's on Skid Row?
Exactly. Right.
Well, David, let's take a short break and then we'll come back and we'll talk more and hear some from the book. You're listening to Living Writers today on the program. David Kellan, he's edited the second volume, Charles Bukowski, Absence of the Hero. We'll be back. Welcome back. If you're just joining us, you've got Living Writers. I'm T. Hetzel. Brian Delaney is in the engineering chair. And today on the program, I'm happy to have David Kellan here. His book, Charles Bukowski, Absence of the Hero, Uncollected Stories and Essays, Volume 2, 1946 to 1992. David, a word about the music. You mentioned in the first quarter Bukowski's love of classical music and your own, actually. Could you talk a little bit about the pieces of music you've chosen for today's show?
Yeah, I picked all composers that Bukowski admired, and we began with Handel, the Concerto Grosso, and then we just segued from Sibelius, the Fifth Symphony. And Bukowski wrote frequently about classical music in his poems and all through his short stories and novels, and he knew a lot about classical music, actually. He read a lot about it. And the other composers are Shostakovich and Mahler and Stravinsky. And I think part of my effort, and you mentioned the first book I did, the interview book, has been to rescue Bukowski from this image of him as this misogynistic, drunken, kind of vulgar person.
Another round for all my friends.
Yeah, right, exactly. But he's actually cultured to the fingertips, and I
wait, what do you mean about that? What do you mean?
Well, I mean that he loved beauty, and he loved beautiful art, and I think that it's obscured by the popular misconception of him as a boorish primitive. I think he was a lot of that was an act. It was like his shtick, you know, of pretending, because he was a deeply sensitive person, I think. And so the whole music thing is very moving for me, since, we have similar taste, I suppose. Cause in fact, there's a section near the end of the Sibelius Fifth Symphony, which I think that Sibelius was probably his favorite composer, which is just, you know, terrific and knocks your socks off where the horns come in. And yeah, so I think that basically he's been misinterpreted very frequently by people who have either read him very superficially or read just some of his work and don't understand really what he was about, which I think is which I'm trying to rescue perhaps partially. I mean, I think that, again, the interview book makes it clear because he talks frequently about music, but then he talks about literature, about Li Po and Celine and Dostoevsky, Turgenev. And even Artaud. In fact, in the first book, I included a review he wrote of Artaud. I mean, who would have thought that Bukowski had read Antonin Artaud, but he did and loved him. So anyway, that's part of what I'm up to. I think I'm trying to show that he's got culture.
Well, and in your introduction, too, one of the ideas you put forth is that he, in his stories and in his poems and essays, he's often referencing these things that are considered high culture.
Right.
Or like other writers, et cetera, and putting them in the same line as something that's considered low culture.
Right.
And you say it's in an effort to equalize the two.
Right.
And maybe that was part of his mission, really, to show that things aren't, there's not just one thing that's meant to be recognized as holy in our culture, especially if it's something that's dusty and only recognized by the academies.
Absolutely. Yeah, I think he's trying to, in fact, he's doing that with poetry too, desacralizing it and sort of saying, you know, I can talk about drinking beer and having a sort of a wild night at the same time I'm listening to Mahler. And he likes that kind of juxtaposition because I think he is bringing it down from Parnassus into the viscerality of everyday life. And I think he's equalizing. I think you're right. And he's also being playful about it. And it's like, we don't have to be snobby about it. And yes. Plus, it's beautiful. And daily life is beautiful too, even in its horror for him. So, I don't think he set out to do it consciously, but he does it because it's natural to him. I think.
And, yes.
And I think he likes to poke fun at pretentiousness all the time. I think and phoniness. And you know, he loved J.D. Salinger too, and who wrote a whole novel about phoniness. So I think that's part of it. Yeah.
And you mentioned right before we came on the air, David, that it would have been his 90th birthday in August.
Yes, right.
And so, and what does that, so this has, this book being coming out this year has a certain, like it feels right to you.
Yeah. In fact, actually I was in Germany in the summer in Andernach, there's a band of Bukowski lovers, there's a Bukowski Gesellschaft. And, I was there with other people who adore him. And, I gave a talk there. And so I got to see his hometown, which I had seen before because I'd been there last year too. But
they left when he was two, David? Is that?
Yes. Yeah. They left when he was two and came to Baltimore first and then Pasadena. And then, basically he was in California, all the way till his early 20s, and then he went on this sort of Wanderjahre. Then he left his parents' house and went to Philadelphia and New York and all over. And in fact, that's where the Barfly story starts, in this bar in Philadelphia. I mean, that's the real place that it took place. And he was a Los Angeles person, though, and he writes about L.A. frequently. And in fact, there's a piece in here about L.A., L.A. poetry. And
how he considers it to be several hours driving in any direction, and
right.
It's still considered that region to be part of the spiritual aspect of the poetry of the area. Yeah, so very much of a place, even though he was born in another country and has traveled widely, lived in other cities, very much of that Southern California, that spirit there somehow.
I think so, yeah. In fact, Barfly was kind of good. Barbe Schroeder made a point of, you know, foregrounding the palm trees and also these very seedy apartments that he lived in, on Mariposa and the Vermont and that part of L.A., Alvarado Street. And then he lived in East Hollywood for a while. All that comes through in the books all the time. But he talks frequently about L.A., you know, plus the point that it's sort of looked down upon as a cultural outpost. And so he kind of makes fun of that too in that essay about, you don't have to be in Paris to write poetry. He says something like that. And that's very true. I mean, but I think he's also thinking of L.A. in the tradition of John Fante and even the crime writers, you know, because his last novel was Pulp, you know, Chandler. And he's very aware of L.A.'s literary past too. And I think and also California in general, I mentioned before, but Robinson Jeffers was a big hero of his, and not many people read Jeffers now, but, he was up in Big Sur, and Bukowski knew about him, and he admired him. So I think there is that sort of not self-consciousness, but he's aware that he's in a Californian literary tradition, which is part of, again, Saroyan too, but...
Yes, and so are you surprised that, because you're very much a part, it seems like that's what your pursuit, your academic obsession
right.
has been,
right.
or just not even just academic, but in your life, like
right.
grafting into you, David.
Right.
So are you surprised that you're here in Michigan and teaching in Ypsilanti, living in Ann Arbor, or...
Yeah, I mean, I have mixed feelings about L.A. I mean, my father didn't like it very much because of the smog and the traffic and the highways, and we ended up moving to a place called Thousand Oaks, which is a suburb of L.A. for my teenage years, and I don't really have any nostalgia about it, about California.
Oaks sounds like one of those new, like in that new suburb time, like where there wasn't a Thousand Oaks, there, you know, but they still called it something like that.
Right. No, it was a real bucolic, very bucolic place. There were really oak trees there, so, but it was nice.
There were maybe 1,000. No one ever was a stickler enough to count them, as I was suggesting, right? Well, even Bukowski gestures to the smog in one of his essays. If the smog doesn't get us, maybe you can resell this book that you bought for $1.35 later on, and it'll be, you know, pay your rent for a month or something. So his humor is always coming. Well, let's hear. Could we hear a piece from your introduction, David? And then when we come back, maybe we'll hear if you'd like to read us some pieces from Bukowski's, like one of the essays we've mentioned or a story.
Sure, I'd be glad to. Actually, one thing I try to do in the introduction is there's been a controversy about Bukowski's relationship to the Beat writers. Mm-hmm. And sometimes he's lumped in with the Beats and literary talk. And it's a difficult issue in some ways because Bukowski in many ways has a lot in common with him. So I tried to trace a bit of that.
Well, Ferlinghetti, it seems like, gave him his first big break with getting him the first reading in San Francisco with City Lights.
That's right.
In 72.
And even earlier, he had appeared with Ferlinghetti in The Outsider in the early 60s, and he was already appearing in a lot of these underground magazines with Ferlinghetti and Ginsberg and Burroughs and blah, blah, blah. In fact, that the Klakdo Vedsedstein that I mentioned before of Carl Wiesner, in that very issue that Bukowski appears in, there's also Ginsberg and there's also Burroughs. So, and then he met Harold Norse, who was also sort of in the Beat orbit. And so there are a lot of, he had been, and in fact, this is interesting. I even would go so far as to say that Bukowski was a Beat before the Beats, and I'm sort of quoting him there, that I think in many ways he was doing many of the things they were before they were, even, and in a different way, but that he had already dropped out of American society, basically.
Did he know Robert Duncan, too, or did he?
No, he wasn't part of that crowd at all.
Sorry, then
but,
go back
no, no.
to your train
but,
of...
Yeah, so, anyway, I'll just read a bit of this, because is there still time before the break? Okay. Indeed, Bukowski's involvement with the underground press, both as contributor and editor, put him in the direct line of combat during the contentious struggle for free speech during the 50s, 60s, and 70s. As early as 1957, Wallace Berman was raided by the L.A. Vice Squad. In 1966, Steve Richmond, who had published Bukowski in his magazines Earth and Earth Rose, had writings from his bookshop in Santa Monica confiscated. D.A. Levy, the dynamo of the Mimeo Revolution, published Bukowski's poem The Genius of the Crowd, which was seized by the police. Quote, Levy was arrested and jailed along with Jim Lowell, proprietor of the great Asphodel Bookshop, a welcoming home for new poetry for over 30 years, on charges of distributing obscene material in Cleveland. Unquote. When John Bryan asked Bukowski to edit Renaissance 2 in September 1968, he solicited a story by Jack Micheline titled Skinny Dynamite about, quote, a red-haired New York girl who liked to fuck, unquote, which resulted in Bryan's arrest. Thus, as a creature of the underground and as an advocate of freedom of speech, Bukowski had always been in sympathy with the ideals of the counterculture. And as we see from his anti-war essay, Peace, Baby is a Hard Sell, 1962, at the beginning of the 60s, Bukowski was in accord with pacifism and love, although he put on the outer mask of the tough guy misanthrope to hide his essential tenderness. It should come as no surprise, then, that Bukowski would have deep links with the Beat writers. Although the nature of his connection to the Beats has been a matter of some controversy among historians, he read their work closely and appeared with many of them in the same publications, such as The Outsider, Evergreen Review, Beatitude, Transatlantic Review, City Lights Anthology, Acid, Neue Amerikanische Szene, unmuzzled ox, el cuerno emplumado, semina, hearse, wild dog, naked ear, and bastard angel. And as the 60s progressed, an increasing number of significant writers and beat circles came to appreciate his work. Kenneth Rexroth would positively review Bukowski's It Catches My Heart in Its Hands in the New York Times on July 5th, 1964. And then in the next section, I talk about his relation to Tor. And then in the next section, I talk about his relation to Harold Norris, who was in the Beat Hotel in Paris. And then the fact that Bukowski reviewed Ginsberg's Empty Mirror in 1967, which I include in this book. In fact, Bukowski liked Ginsberg. This is also another misnomer that he has a section where he basically says Ginsberg really opened up American poetry, and he read him very closely. Then he writes in 1967, he encountered Neil Cassady, who was Dean Moriarty in Kerouac's On the Road, who became the subject of one of Bukowski's Notes of a Dirty Old Man columns. In 1969, he appeared with Norris and Philip Lamantia in Penguin Poets 13. And Lamantia was an Italian-American poet who was also associated with the Beats. So, and then, as you said, Ferlinghetti published A Dirty Old Man, the reprint of it anyway, and invited him to San Francisco. So just there you can see quite a few links. And then there are also stories I include in the book where he meets Gregory Corso. He liked Gregory Corso and Jack Michelin. So I think that's been ignored in literary history about him. I think he really was in sympathy with many of the ideals of the counterculture, basically.
Yeah, definitely. But still also wanting to be an outsider, because railing against the university, the academy, what he pictured as some people making decisions and safe, just going towards safe things,
right.
I don't know. But and it seems like also railing a bit against Robert Creeley, you mentioned.
That was his bete noire, Robert Creeley.
Yeah, well, let's take a short break, and we'll be back to hear more from David Kalan, his book, Charles Bukowski, Absence of the Hero, Uncollected Stories and Essays, Volume 2. I'm T. Hetzel. You've got Living Writers. We'll be back. You're listening to WCBN FM Ann Arbor. I wish we could always have that music playing with WCBN FM Ann Arbor's name coming right after it. David, you were loving it. Today on the program, David Kalan here, his book, Charles Bukowski, Absence of the Hero. Bukowski also loved this piece. You were like, here come the drums. You were really ready.
Yeah, that was Shostakovich's 10th Symphony. And I just wanted to read just one line from a poem that Bukowski wrote called 2 A.M., and it's about this piece. He says, "So now Shostakovich's 10th, 2 A.M., closing time, but not here, tonight. Dmitri spins it out, and I borrow from his immense psyche. I feel better and better and better listening to him. He cures me onward, each drink finer, my stupid wounds closing." The 10th goes on, circling these walls. I owe this bastard.
Yeah, that's great.
But he has a lot of poems like that where he's he's writing about Mahler or Stravinsky or whatever, and he's in this completely personal relationship with the music, and that he kind of recounts how it helps him and turns him on and excites him.
But isn't that what good art, that's why we're making, that's why we're hoping to make something that could be art that reaches across time and to whatever, to give someone hope or to give them some sort of strength to keep going or...
Right.
And not maybe to feel like someone owes you something, somebody will one day owe me something, but more just to be part of whatever keeps humanity being human going, right?
Yeah, I don't know. He's got one about Wagner called My German Buddy, and he talks about listening to Wagner and getting goosebumps, and it is terrific stuff. So anyway.
And so that is amazing. And one of the lines that you quote in your introduction to David, the hard life created the hard line, and by the hard line I mean the true line, devoid of ornament. Which is interesting because that's almost it's working in contrast with what music can do, which is like feel like a fullness almost, giving you a fullness. But maybe that was what was needed to sustain him. Yeah, so it's interesting. So Bukowski was reviewed, from what you read to us in the last quarter of the hour, in 1964 in the New York Times.
Right.
So he had really made it at that point. Like, he was not an outsider.
And it's interesting that it was Rex Roth who was sort of, my point there was he's sort of the ringleader of the Beats. He was the one who organized the big reading at the gallery in San Francisco when Ginsberg read Howl, and that he was aware of him. And but you're right. 64 was the New York Times is not bad. So he's starting to get known by then. Yeah.
And just for a moment, other quotes that you mention as in jokes for devoted Bukowskians. I love that there's Bukowskians. Genius could mean the ability to say a profound thing in a simple way. And then endurance is more important than truth.
Right. Yeah, that's a passage from the Big Dope reading where he, which is an account of a reading he gave. And I mean, it's a fictionalized account of a reading he gave in Florida. And
on words, isn't it?
I think so. At least I thought so. Big Dope reading. Dope and dope, right? But he's, I'm glad you brought this up because we talked about it, a bit about it before. We went on about his playfulness. He makes fun of himself. I mean, it's self-parody because here he is, the character Chinaski, quoting Bukowski, really. These his two most famous little sayings. And there's a lot of that. And that's also where people have gotten him wrong about misogyny. And he's said this himself. Yes, sometimes he makes fun of women, but he makes fun of himself just as much or more. And I think that... one has to keep in mind the parodist and the ironist in Bukowski at all times. He's very, very hip about the subtleties of gender warfare. And people tend to take him at face value, and in which case they misread him completely, I think. So I tried to talk a bit about that, too, in the introduction. In fact, I even quote Lacan, you know, his famous saying, there is no sexual relationship. You know, this idea that he's playing with that all the time, you know, that... that love relationships are full of sort of delusion, and he's always trying to break through into something real with the person, with the woman he's in love with. And it's a struggle, and it's back and forth, and there are moments when he really achieves that intimacy. But a lot of the time, it's war all the time, like he says in one of his poetry books. It's not easy. But he's Lawrencian in that way. He loved D.H. Lawrence. He wrote about D.H. Lawrence. And that's what Lawrence's great theme was. How do you break through to their authentic connection with someone?
And, well, mentioning also the playfulness in that, too, I'm not sure which story it was in. I'm wondering if it is in the 80 airplanes. Does that make sense?
Oh, yes.
When he's talking about he and his lady, and they're trying with the 69, and now they keep getting interrupted.
Oh, no, that's another one. That's the that's one of the autobiographical.
Oh, okay.
Well, that's the Henry Miller one, I think.
Oh, is it the Henry Miller Lives in Palisades and I Live on Skid Row? Okay. Well, anyway, but there's humor. There's just everybody.
Right.
Anyway, well, actually.
Well, he quotes Boccaccio. I mean, he says that he loved Boccaccio's Decameron because it was so funny about sex, and that sex, I mean, sex is comedy, basically. And the other thing is James Thurber, because Bukowski was a wonderful cartoonist. And when you look at his cartoons, yes, they're very similar to Thurber. And Thurber, that's his great theme, you know, is sex really necessary? He's always making fun of sex. And I think Thurber is much more important than people think with Bukowski.
Did they know each other?
I don't think he ever met him, but he liked him very much.
And so, yeah, and you bring up, I love that Bukowski actually illustrated some of his own writings. And is that something that you'll be also publishing, or is it already out there, David?
Like, it's looking at some of those. It's funny you say that, because I tried to get City Lights to use some of his cartoons, and I hope in the next book they do, because
Stacy Lewis, if you're listening at City Lights, hi Stacy, everybody at City Lights.
Because he was a very talented, you know, LA City College. He actually took art for a while. I think he had art and journalism, and when his books were published in private editions, in limited editions, he would contribute paintings. So many of them, they're quite expensive on the collector's market. He'd do an actual oil painting and include it in the text. And he liked to paint. He painted a lot. And so
he was painting, drawing, writing poems,
right,
stories,
right,
essays. And then he was doing all sorts of odd jobs and working at the post office,
right,
to make ends meet so that what he could do what he wanted.
Right. Very much so. And I mean, I guess you get all three arts, poetry, music, and his love of music and painting.
Did he play instruments too, David?
No. Although there's a picture of him at the piano. He has that poetry book, play the piano like a percussion instrument until you're fingers begin to bleed a bit, but you know, he was just pounding on it. But no, he didn't play any instrument. Played the radio. You know, that's the whole thing, is that he used to like to write with the radio on all the time. You know, and that was his real ritual.
And you mentioned earlier that when you were working at the Laverty collection and other places, like, you've been photocopying, you've also collected on, it sounds like, eBay and different pieces.
Right.
So are you amassing your own Bukowski archive, David, or?
Not really. I mean, I'm not a collector, but I did, because of wanting to put these books together, I did it sort of practically, but I've gone through this sort of mania before. I did it with Saroyan. Because I wanted to read every—I mean, I'm sure everybody is like that who really loves a writer. You want to read everything they've written. And so I did that with Saroyan and Henry Miller also. I think I have just about everything both of them wrote. But it's a kind of—it's selfish. It's just a desire to give myself more pleasure by reading everything they wrote.
But what you're doing here with these volumes and with City Lights' help is being unselfish, where you're trying to bring these works,
right,
back into,
right,
to the light of day. Because even, you know, there's on the back of this, of the volume two, is a blurb by Tom Waits, you know, and he's, you know, glad to see more of him in the world, and Brian Evanson.
Right.
So this seems unselfish, trying to bring him back into the sunlight.
Right.
Well, would you like to read a bit of, like, a short piece from one of Bukowski's stories or essays?
Sure. Actually, there is the one you mentioned also. Actually, there's one called The House of Horrors, which is about writing. And this was actually appeared in Playboy in April. They excerpted it. And I thought that was kind of nice, because Bukowski had been published in the French and German Playboys, but never in the American edition of Playboy. And he had submitted stories to them. In fact, one of them I include in this book called Christ with Barbecue Sauce, which was rejected by Playboy, but which is a really neat story. But so anyway, so now he has finally appeared.
His time
has come to be in that august literary publication. But okay, so this is The House of Horrors. Talking about writing is like talking about love, or lovemaking, or love living. Too much talk about it can kill it off. Without seeking them out, I have unfortunately met many writers, both successful and unsuccessful, I mean at their craft. As human beings, they are a bad lot, a distasteful lot, bitchy, self-centered, vicious. One thing they almost all have in common, they each believe their work great, perhaps the greatest. If they become successful, they accept it as their normal due. If they fail, they feel that the editors and the publishers and the gods are against them. And it's true that many bad writers are pushed and manipulated to the top, whatever the reason may be. It's also true that many great writers have starved to death, or almost starved to death, or killed themselves, or gone mad, and so forth, and were later discovered as fine, though dead, talents. This historical fact gives heart to the writer who is truly bad. He likes to imagine that his, her failure is caused by any number of things besides simply being a poor talent. Well, so we have all that. Also, when I think of the writers that I know, mostly poets, I notice they are supported by others. Wives, mostly mothers, carry the economic load of those that I know, and they are quite comfortable with TV sets, loaded refrigerators and apartments or houses by the sea, mostly at Venice and Santa Monica, and they sun themselves in the day, feeling tragic, these male friends of mine, and then at night, perhaps a bottle of wine and a watercress sandwich, followed by a wailing letter of their penury and greatness to somebody somewhere. Anything but writing, working, getting it done, getting the word down. Well, I guess it beats working a punch press. The wives and the mothers will work the punch press. Don't worry about that. And the poets, having not lived in the outside world, in reality, they will then really have nothing to write about, which they do with great ego and much dullness. It is almost impossible to write about writing. I remember once after giving a poetry reading, I asked the students, any questions? One of them asked me, why do you write? And I answered, why do you wear that red shirt? Being a writer is damning and difficult. If you have a talent, it can leave you forever while you are sleeping one night. What keeps you going in the game is not easy to answer. Too much success is destructive. No success at all is destructive. A little rejection is good for the soul, but total rejection creates cranks and madmen, rapists, sadists, drunkards, and wife beaters, just as too much success does. I, too, have been misled by the romantic concept of writing. As a youth, I saw too many movies of the great artist, and the writer was always some tragic and very interesting chap with a fine goatee, blazing eyes, and inner truths springing to his tongue continually. What a way to be, I thought. Ah, but it isn't so. The best writers that I know talk very little. I mean those who are doing the good writing. In fact, there is nothing duller than a good writer. In a crowd or even with one other person, he is always busy, subconsciously recording every goddamn thing. He is not interested in speech making or being the life of the party. He is greedy. He saves his juices for the typewriter. You can talk away inspiration. You can destroy God-given genius with your mouth. Energy will only spread so far. I, too, am greedy. One must be. The only juices that can be given up, the only time that can simply be given away is the time for love. Love gives strength. It breaks down inbred hatreds and prejudices. It makes the writing more full. But all other things must be saved for the work. A writer should do most of his reading while he is young. As he starts to form, reading becomes destructive. It takes the needle off the record. A writer must keep performing, hitting the high mark, or he is down on Skid Row, and there's no way back up. For after some years of writing, the soul, the person, the creature becomes useless to operate in any other capacity. He is unemployable. He is a bird in a land of cats. I'd never advise anybody to become a writer, only if writing is the only thing which keeps you from going insane. Then, perhaps, it's worth it.
Thank you. You're listening to Living Writers. That was David Kalan reading Charles Bukowski. We'll be right back. Welcome back. You've got Living Writers. I'm T. Hetzel, and today on the program, I'm so pleased to have here David Kalan. His latest, Charles Bukowski, Absence of the Hero, Uncollected Stories and Essays, Volume 2, 1946 to 1992. Well, as we've discovered, there's actually a whole lot to say. So thank you so much for being on the program, David, today.
Sure.
And we'd like to remind everyone that tonight, David Kalan will be speaking at Borders downtown here at 7 o'clock with many copies of Absence of the Hero available. And it's really great because let's say you're not a Bukowskian yet, but this would also could be a great introduction to him because of it sampling his essays
and
stories.
And what I tried to do is, as I did with portions from a Weinstein notebook, is shift back and forth between story and essay and sort of trace his literary trajectory, if you will. I mean, he wrote a lot of manifestos, essays about writing, and especially early on, he was really trying to create a niche for himself as a poet outside of the schools of American poetry, you know, the confessionals and the Black Mountain poets. And I think there's a lot of very conscious aesthetic commentary in Bukowski, where he's really trying to say what he's up to as a poet, and that he's really trying to blaze a new trail in American poetry, which is, in a way, coming out of William Carlos Williams and E. Cummings. There is a playful, but there's also a very kind of imagistic specificity about his poetry often, and the Whitmanian long line. He doesn't have rhyming. He's not a formalist by any means, but
or the Emily Dickinson random capitalization too,
right?
How he was playing with the visual.
Yes.
And I wanted to mention Emily Dickinson because when I read that in your introduction, I didn't seem to see many women's names of writers that he looked to or who fed him.
Just Carson McCullers. He loved her. Yes.
Heart is a lonely hunter. So there's that. And so when I saw that like random capitalization, I thought, oh, Dickinson. So there's like some echo that here.
Yes, very much so. And E. Cummings, and he would write whole essays with lowercase and play with that. And I talk about that in the introduction. I mean, I make the claim that he's kind of an action writer, the way Pollock was an action painter.
Yes.
I mean, that he's putting his whole force into the act of writing, and that includes this shifting in typography, playfulness, and also, sometimes even arranging words all over the page. And sometimes it's hard to tell whether he's written a poem or a piece of prose. He really breaks that boundary between the two frequently. It's not poetry, it's not prose, and it's not prose poetry. It's like he's genre bending frequently.
And by connecting him to other artists like Jackson Pollock, for example, are you also putting him in that time, like how others were working? Because Pollock's of a similar time, right? And so so I'm thinking, is that one of the things that you were doing in the introduction to orient people as well, like to what was happening at the time with art and what Americans were doing?
Yes, and even expressionism, you know, German expressionism, because he was German after all. And Robert Crumb, I think of Robert Crumb as sort of an American expressionist, and it's no accident that Crumb illustrated Bukowski, because there's this emphasis on extreme emotion but with this kind of black humor. I think there's very much that aspect of Bukowski. In fact, it struck me that Bukowski came to fame in the early 70s at the same time that Fassbinder and Werner Herzog's movies were hitting the United States. Very similar, extreme emotion, intensity, madness, Edvard Munch, The Scream, all that stuff. But with Bukowski, with the added leaven of humor and of lightness of touch and playfulness, which is what Robert Crumb does, I think. It's got all those elements of expressionism, but it's, or a movie like Eraserhead, which was one of Bukowski's favorite movies. I mean, David Lynch is also playing around with that same territory, I think.
Well, what is it like? Because it seems like you know Bukowski intimately. Did you get a chance to meet him before
no,
he
I never
died,
met him.
David?
No.
So what is it like now to be the person who in the last, you know, decade or so is looking out for his uncollected stories
and
essays?
Well, I had some trepidation, I must say, at the beginning. I contacted John Martin. He's been marvelous. And I should say he wrote me a letter recently praising me, and it was very touching for me because I felt like I wasn't stepping into his shoes as Bukowski's editor, but I was very conscious of the fact that Martin discovered Bukowski really and put him on the literary map. And so in a way, I've tried to continue his tradition. I've tried to be faithful to his work and edit it properly, and hopefully the introductions are useful for readers. But
when you find a story or essay, some of them have been published elsewhere or in other journals.
Right.
So how are you choosing the ones for each volume, David? And how are you actually going in, and are you doing line editing? Or are some of them even pieces that you've found that haven't been published, and so you're actually maybe even typing them into the computer for the first time?
Or... Yes. In fact, the House of Horrors is an example of that. It's in manuscript at the University of Arizona Library, and that's never been published.
That must be so exciting then.
It was. Some of them, I must say, the images to me is like finding this gem. There's several short stories in here that they're just very fine, and it is exciting. It's a bit like... an archaeologist finding a buried treasure. Because he was so prolific. I mean, he was astonishingly prolific. So there's a lot of stuff still that hasn't been collected in book form. So it's fun.
and was there a reason you chose certain ones for volume one, and then you knew you had a plan for volume two? Because I know you said you wanted to have stories and essays in both and move between them.
Yes, I think the volume one. We ended up deciding to include the very first short story, which was an aftermath of a lengthy rejection slip. So for volume two, I still wanted to include some of the early stories because people don't know that he wrote these stories in the 40s, 44 to 46, 47, 48, and they're marvelous. There's one called "The Reason Behind Reason" that I begin this book with, which is a kind of Jean-Paul Sartre meditation on alienation, which is a marvelous thing. So I think in both books I wanted to include the very early work that no one had ever really seen before. So that's what I did.
Well, I'll look forward to talking with you again when Volume 3 comes out, because there's more to say. And David, to take us out, would you mind reading the very last page of the book? And I'll just say... David Kalan will be reading tonight at Borders, 7 o'clock. His latest, as editor, Charles Bukowski, Absence of the Hero, Uncollected Stories and Essays, Volume 2, 1946 to 1992. I'm T. Hetzel. You've been listening to Living Writers. And now David will take us out in the words of Charles Bukowski.
This is the very last essay in the book, Playing and Being the Poet, the last paragraph. But I've talked enough about writing poetry here. There is still time tonight to write some. A few beers, a cigar, classical music on the radio. See you later.
Until next time.